Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Joyce El Khoury. The first-year Academy of Vocal Arts resident artist is the winner of this year's Jarjarian Son Bel Canto competition. In this, the second and final weekend of this year's Philadelphia Open Studio Tours, Susan Lewis talks to artists about making art and visits them in their creative spaces. And Jason Piper visits the touring company of Dublin's Gate Theatre. As part of their Samuel Beckett Centenary Festival, they're staging Waiting for Godot in Philadelphia. And we'll have a review of that production from our critic at large, Leslie Valdez. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Bel canto, translated, means beautiful singing and describes the light and airy tone of Italian opera singers, a singing style cultivated since the 16th and 17th centuries. The Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia's first bel canto competition in 1985 was initiated and funded by AVA patron Oreste Jarjari, working in collaboration with maestro Christopher Makatsouris. The competition featured the bel canto repertoire, all sung in Italian. Since then, it has expanded to include other operatic styles and languages. The past 3 years' winners of the contest have all been tenors: Stephen Costello last year, Jeffrey Halili in 2004, and Dong Wan Shin in 2003. This year's winner was Canadian-born soprano Joyce El Khoury. She graduated from the University of Ottawa and is in her first year as a resident artist at AVA. Miss El Khoury came into our studios earlier this week. So congratulations once again. Are you still glowing in the aftermath of your victory last Friday?
Yes, definitely. It was a wonderful experience and I'm very happy about it.
What was your sense going into it? Because it's a very competitive environment. Without being in any way negative, there's 18 singers backstage. Everybody is there to do their very best. Did you have a sense of what your chances were before the competition started?
Well, to be honest, what was really nice before we all started singing, and we were all backstage actually talking about this, is that we did not feel any negative energy or negative competition per se. We are all friends and it just felt like a concert and we were all just having fun, and that's what was wonderful about it. And I really had no idea how I was going to do because I had been sick the entire week. So I said, you know, I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to sing and it'll be what it'll be. And there you have it.
And it was.
And it was.
And on the night, was it a particularly strong performance by your own standards?
I think it was a good one. I think it was a good one. I was happy with it given the situation and not feeling well. But I think that it was difficult because I couldn't judge. I had no idea. I just had to go out there and do it and then have no thoughts about it afterward.
Because, of course, you couldn't see the other performances.
No, exactly. But it felt fine. It felt fine. But like I said, I had no idea. So you just have to go out there and trust that you've done your work up until that point and that it'll be there.
How far are you into your residency at AVA at this point? You're a second year, is it?
I'm a first year.
You're a first year. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So 3 more years to go.
Yes.
Where does it go from here? Because I think a lot of the time, and I'm not sure that most people are aware of the career, the timeline of an opera singer's career, in that unlike other musicians, you can be 18 and get a seat in an orchestra. You can be 25 and be the concertmaster of an orchestra. A lot more is possible when the instrument is not a part of your body, per se.
Right.
In the case of opera singers, you are dependent on the physical maturing of the voice to get these big parts. I often wonder, how do opera singers survive through their 20s into their early 30s?
Well, it's very tricky and you have to be very patient. And I think the scary part is that some young singers aren't patient. It's very difficult. The good thing about AVA is that we get to try out these big roles in a safe environment, a training environment where we're being encouraged and supported and we're being trained. And then I think for me, what will happen after AVA is I will do roles that are appropriate for me at that age and then let the other ones cook for a while. I think you just need time and you need to surround yourself with people, teachers, coaches, managers that are looking out for your well-being and that will not push you into anything too soon. Because it's very easy for a singer to say, oh, I love this role. I want to do it now. And it's, you know, Tosca, and you're not ready until you're 40, you know.
So. But it is irresistible. I mean, if somebody were, if any opera company, be they large or small, were to turn around and say, here you go.
Of course.
It would be difficult to say
it
no.
It would be extremely difficult. But the way I think of it is, if the offers are there now, they'll be there later when I'm that much better and that much more developed. You just have to wait.
The competitions are important. We were talking to, while we were calculating the votes of the listener poll on Sunday during the broadcast, we were talking to Jeffrey Halili about the importance of these competitions because they are a very good resume builder. Is that something that down the line will stand to you, do you think, winning the Jarjari competition?
Oh, I'm sure, especially with all these wonderful singers. And, you know, everyone got to hear them on the radio, and it's an honor. Yeah, I'm very happy about it. I think it will definitely be on my resume, and I'm happy that it's there.
Sempre libero di Dio folleggiar di gioia in gioia fu che scorra il viver mio per i sentieri del piacer nasca il giorno moia sempre libero mi ritrovi
excerpt from Joyce El Khoury's Bel Canto competition winning performance from Violetta's Act 1 scene from Verdi's La Traviata. Miss Khoury can next be heard in the role of Tatiana in the Academy of Vocal Arts concert production of Eugene Onegin. Two extra performances on December 8th and 10th have been added to the series after the initial two-concert run sold out.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new things I'm learning about you day by day.
It's rare for members of the public to have access to artists at work. The privilege of studio visits is usually reserved for close friends and valued clients. Yet on two weekends each fall, more than 230 artists in Philadelphia throw open their doors as part of the Philadelphia Open Studio Tours. Last weekend, studios west of Broad Street opened, and WRTI's Susan Lewis spent some time getting to know artists in their workspaces.
We're standing outside Sherman Mills in East Falls, one of the bigger sites in the city. It is what it sounds like, an old mill building just up the hill from the river. It has retail space, residential units, and lots of artists of all sorts. Let's go inside. It feels like you're walking backstage somewhere. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Who are you and what are you doing?
My name's Kate Common. And I make large-scale sculpture. It's mostly site-specific. And some smaller pieces, too, for galleries. But mostly public art.
So we're standing right next to this giant suspended bumblebee?
Yeah, I made it up. It's a flower bumblebee.
And what's over here?
Well, this is a video of the last large installation we did here at the Mills for the owner, Mark Sherman. we suspended four ring shapes that are about 8 feet in diameter from an 80-foot tower down to a 14-foot roof. So when you look through the skyline, you see these rings that are floating in the sky, kind of framing different sections of the sky. And
is everybody here an artist in the Mills?
No, there's residents, people that just live here. There's companies, everyone from design firms to photographers to sculptors to painters.
What's it like to have the open studio tours? Did you have to prepare for this, or did you just open your door? What did you do?
We did a lot of preparation. Specifically, the community really got together, organized, said, we're going to put a food table here and there and a banner here and a banner there. And me personally, I cleaned my studio.
Well, thank you. What is your name and what do you do?
Emily Selvin, and I have a leaded glass studio.
And are you working today?
Yes, I am.
What are you doing?
Letting up a window that I have made for a client. So it's cut out here, and we're in the process of putting all the lead in between each piece of glass.
Can you work with all these people around?
It's difficult. So in between people, I might get one piece of glass in and then have to stop and chat and then another piece. So I've done, 8 inches over there and however many hours I've been here since 10. And usually that whole panel would be done, which is about 12 inches wide. So not too much work. It's good to have people through and have them talk to me about what they see, and kind of gives me fresh eyes on my studio. Since I'm here all the time, I don't always get to see what's going on in here. So having other people talk to me about my work is very good.
And what are people most curious about?
The technique, definitely. How it's done, where the glass comes from. A lot of people are curious about the lead poisoning issues because I do work with lead. So they wonder what I do for safety.
What do you do for safety?
We tape up. See this green tape that I have on my fingers? Keeps the lead out. We tape up our tools that have lead on them. We wear respirators when we solder, and we've got a really noisy exhaust fan up there in the window that we'll put on when we're soldering as well.
How did you get into this?
Well, I lied to an Episcopalian bishop who came to my studio when I was at Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I was experimenting with glass, had nothing to do with my work at all, and she said, I see you do stained glass, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, yeah, I do stained glass, and she on the spot commissioned me, and turns out she was a bishop, and my first job was a church.
Can you just tell me about the guy across the hall? What does he do?
Jesse Harrington. Does wonderful sculptures. He also works for churches, and he has a really good eye for the body in sculpture.
I have a couple different projects going on right now. The biggest is a life-size stone marble Madonna and Child. It's a commission that's being donated to a church in Ambler. I started carving it in January. I started concepting for it last year around this time. So it's been going on for quite a while.
And what's it like for you to have people wandering around your studio?
It's a little odd, but in here every day by myself, just carving away or concepting. It's kind of nice to have people come through and see what you're doing and appreciate the process and not just see the finished product on a wall somewhere in a gallery or on a podium somewhere.
Do you actually start with a block of...
No, I'll start, if we go back in this room, over here we have... My concepting table here is where I do all my maquettes and studies, and I'll start with little 6 to 12 inch wax maquettes that I'll do. I heat the wax up and just mold them into different forms and just do little studies, and then I'll do a larger version in clay, usually about 24 to 36 inches. And then after that, I'll do a full-scale model in clay, cast that into plaster. And then from there, I start taking measurements off the plaster and putting them into the stone.
This is a good place to work. I guess it can get noisy.
It gets very noisy. Between the compressor, the air chisels, the grinders are just awful. I have to wear respirators and, you know.
Wow, so I hear this is the noisy part of the building, and there is a quiet.
Absolutely. And luckily, my neighbors are very tolerant.
What is your name?
Owen Patch.
And you're a glassblower?
I am a glassblower. I built the shop here, and I'm the studio director. There are a lot of different variables and factors involved in what we do, and we sort of learn to work with those.
What's the trickiest thing about learning this?
I guess what gives people a lot of trouble is the initial gathering from the furnace, because it's a bit intimidating. You open this door and you look inside and there's a pool of glass, and you have to stick a pipe or a punty into that and twist up a little bit, and it's quite hot.
So what are you making today?
I'm going to make a perfume bottle. So we're going to open the door to the furnace.
What comes out is this...
It's sort of like honey, except it's 2,000 degrees. And I'm going to smooth this and shape it a little bit. And then I'm going to blow into the pipe and cap the end of it with my thumb. And the pressure inside the column will cause a bubble to blow out on the end of the pipe. I've been blowing glass for 20 years, and I'm still filled with wonderment with every gather. It's an amazing material. It's fluid. It's hot. It's sort of have a mind of its own. And even though we use the material, it uses us as well. We have this intense relationship with the material. Everybody has their own relationship. Last week I did a demonstration for the National Liberty Museum, and I made a comment that this is the longest relationship I've ever had with anything in my life, save my family. I'm also fond of saying that the work is not of me, it's through me. So when I make work, I'm sort of channeling so that I can just collaborate with the material and make something that's special. We all love what we do, and glass people aren't normal, so you need to know that straight away. We're all just a little off, but we love what we do.
Great. Thanks so much.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Philadelphia Open Studio Tours are free to the public and continue this weekend, with studios west of Broad Street open today and tomorrow from 12 till 6. Maps with studio locations are available at philaopenstudios.com, or you can follow the link from our website, www.wrti.org. Samuel Beckett is one of those familiar names. Many have certainly heard of him and could probably guess he was an important 20th century writer. But beyond these basics, a lot of people might not have much more to say about Beckett. This year marks Samuel Beckett's 100th birthday, and this week the writer's most famous play, Waiting for Godot, is touring through Philadelphia. Jason Pfeiffer has more on the legacy of Beckett and the perceived complexity of his work.
Godot or Godot? Which is it? Here in the United States, many say Godot, but elsewhere, in the UK, for example, it's often pronounced Godot. Beckett himself instructed people to say Godot, so we'll go with that here. But this simple, perhaps even trivial, discrepancy serves to demonstrate the diversity of thought on Beckett and his 1952 work, Waiting for, well, you know. A lot has been said about Beckett, and the approaches to his work vary greatly. Born in Ireland in 1906, the Nobel Prize-winning writer was not only a playwright, but also a novelist and poet. In his younger years, he worked closely with and was deeply influenced by another Irish writer, James Joyce. Throughout his life, Beckett also developed close ties with French culture. He's now buried in France. Many of his literary works were originally written in French, and he even joined the French resistance during World War II. Beckett lived through both of the world wars, devastating conflicts that transformed the global political and philosophical landscape. One movement that came to prominence in this era was existentialism, a philosophy that tends to view life as absurd and meaningless. Influenced by this school of thought, Beckett wrote his first play, Waiting for Godot, in the late 1940s. The play concerns Vladimir and Estragon, two tramps who pass the evening hours in conversation and quarreling as they wait alongside a road for the arrival of someone known as Godot. In contrast to a more conventional drama, there isn't a whole lot that technically happens beyond this waiting for Godot. Temple University theater history professor Bob Headley explains that the play caught the attention of many people when it premiered because it was so uniquely open-ended, subject to a variety of interpretations. The work helped redefine what a theater drama could look like. Headley says the first audiences found Godot both intriguing and maddening.
And there was so much controversy in newspapers, in journals, people writing articles disputing other people's articles on the meaning of Beckett's plays. This, after all, at the time the play was written, was a time when realism and the kind of easy presentation of answers to virtually all of life's questions were in the plays. And yet, here's a writer comes along and refuses to answer any questions, either through his plays or in person.
Waiting for Godot was the first ever play produced by Philadelphia's Lantern Theater back in 1994. The theater company's co-founder and artistic director, Charles McMahon, directed that staging. He says that the play has a very dreamlike quality that essentially defies rational analysis.
It has the sort of emotional resonance that you get from a dream that is strange but very engaging. And this is strange and it's alien. It's not part of everyday human experience, but it is engaging. And there's something familiar about the environment of the play, something eerie and frighteningly familiar.
One quality of Waiting for Godot that's often noted is the frequent pauses in dialogue that Beckett wrote into the script. McMahon says that from a directing and acting standpoint, these pauses go against the traditional dramatic instinct to fill moments of silence with some sort of action or business.
I think they demand a certain amount of faith from the actors that they can actually sit there on stage doing nothing at all for a full 12 seconds, 15 seconds, you know, some unimaginable period of time where they can literally just not do anything. And that was one of the great performance challenges.
Since 1990, the Gate Theatre in Dublin, Ireland, has staged festivals that feature all 19 of Beckett's plays. Alan Stanford, a veteran actor with the Gate, has been performing Waiting for Godot off and on for about 18 years. He's currently in the touring Godot production at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia. In Stanford's view, it's important to make Beckett plays, like Waiting for Godot, more accessible.
One of the curses that Beckett was faced with was that because the play was considered avant-garde and therefore deeply intellectual, is that after its first initial rush, it tended to get ignored by mainstream theatre. So Beckett became the victim of undergraduate theatre. So you had an awful lot of productions that were trying to make it deep and make it meaningful and make it esoteric and make it absurdist, instead of just looking at the script and saying the words.
A simple approach to Waiting for Godot can be hard to come by because there are so many unknowns in the story, such as who are Estragon and Vladimir? Where exactly are they? Why are they waiting for Godot? And who is this Godot? Alan Stanford.
Beckett most decidedly and absolutely doesn't say who he is. The only thing he insists on is that it's pronounced Godot. And he said, with a twinkle in his eye and a wink at the questioner, because it sort of sounds like God. But he doesn't mean that it is. He doesn't mean that it isn't. Because what you're waiting for is what you are waiting for. So if what you are waiting for is your just reward in heaven, then that's right. That's what your Godot is. If what you are waiting for is a hot meal and somewhere warm to sleep, then that's what Godot is for you. Too many people, for too long, have overinterpreted the play.
Whether or not the historic heavy analysis of Waiting for Godot has been beneficial, both Stanford and Temple professor Bob Headley advise audience members to lay aside preconceptions of the work once seated in the theater.
There are profound things to be learned from Beckett. There are profound experiences to have. However, if you enter into the play saying to yourself, now this is profound stuff and I've got to really put on my thinking cap and do that, I think you miss the play. These plays, they're very hard to do because, in an ironic way, people take them too seriously.
If done right, Headley says the play is actually extremely funny and engaging. It's been 54 years since Waiting for Godot was first published, originally in French, and already the play has gained a legendary status. For those who still haven't gotten around to seeing it, Waiting for Godot may be just the play you've been waiting for.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez has been to see the Gate Theatre of Dublin's touring production of Waiting for Godot at the Zellerbach Theatre and has this review.
I waited to see Waiting for Godot a long time, so of course I was excited when the Gate Theatre Dublin came to the Annenberg Centre. It was the proverbial dark and stormy night, and many of us arrived soaked. The play started late. I was weary. Tea would have helped. But the inconveniences felt suitable to this dark, strange comedy. When Barry McGovern as Vladimir takes out a carrot to hand Estragon, I could have munched it too. Johnny Murphy as Estragon or Gogo, the dreamer of the pair. The tramp whose feet always hurt because he fails to remove his boots at night. The one who never attends to the details. The pessimist. Nothing to be done, says Estragon. But Vladimir persists in holding out some hope. Perhaps the elusive Godot will come and change their luck. Hope deferred maketh something sick. Who said that? Vladimir quotes. Every now and then, he feels hope welling up inside. But most of the time, these two chaplain-esque characters dally back and forth, doing nothing and saying more, or less. But a lot is implied, and stage silences are filled. And in the laughter that erupts, we recognize ourselves, getting on with getting on and through the habitual days and nights, sometimes with hope, how often with despair. Should we go on? The two are always asking that. All my life I've tried to put it from me, saying, Vladimir, be reasonable. You haven't yet tried everything, and I resumed the struggle, the character says. But now Vladimir is coming round to the opinion that his more pessimistic pal may be right. No sense going on. Unless maybe this time Gatto may arrive. These bums have the most expressive faces, and their acting is very fine. So is that of Alan Stanford and Stephen Brennan, who play Pozzo and Lucky, respective master and slave in the charade that disrupts and entertains Vladimir's and Estragon's tedious long day. 2 days, actually, one for each of the play's acts. The Pozzo of Stanford is a bully in the first act. He crumbles in the second, for now he is blind and bitter. The acting here is savage and superb. Brennan, as Lucky, has a tour de force stream of intellectual verbiage to spout when called upon to think. It drew a tremendous round of applause. Otherwise, he must act the part of a human beast of burden, a slave who never puts down his baggage, even when he can. The direction misses a moment of epiphany here. It should be startling when you realize, despite the noose around his neck, Lucky's free to go. There are several moments in this production that miss their mark. They may be due to timing miscalculations, and the staging design could also be more confined, reined in. Director Walter Asmus is no doubt used to working in more intimate theaters than the Zellerbach, venues with swifter acoustics, too. The actors, hopefully, do not often suffer the indignities of audience chatter, as happened opening night. Bizarrely, someone whispered, "This is the end," just before Vladimir and Estragon uttered their final, "Shall we go on?" The Zellerbach Theater has been revamped. Seats are more comfortable now, and sightlines better. There are ramps for the handicapped. But the venue is still too large to ideally accommodate this dreamlike play. There's a music to Beckett, which was originally penned in French. We need to hear it. Even in English, the repetition of sentences, the silences, the circularity is exquisite. It requires precision and rapt attention. I couldn't hear every line, nor could friends attending the following night. Of course, many are repeated. This endless repetition is the point. Who is your Gatto? Christ? The Pennsylvania Lottery? The perfect match? No matter. Everyone is waiting.
WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez. The Gate Theatre of Dublin's production of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Gatto is at the Annenberg Centre for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia's University City through tomorrow afternoon. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Stephanie Grant, Karen Lyman, Pat Allen, Denise Stewart and Andrew Peary. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.